Until relatively recently, in the evolutionary scale of things, the wildlife of New Zealand consisted of almost nothing but birds. Only birds could reach the place. The ancestors of many of the birds that are now natives of New Zealand originally flew there. There are also a couple of species of bats, which are mammals, but, and this is the point, there were no predators. No dogs, no cats, no ferrets or weasels. Nothing that the birds needed to escape from, particularly. And flight, of course, is a means of escape. It's a survival mechanism, and one that some of the birds of New Zealand found they didn't especially need. Flying is hard work and consumes a lot of energy. Not only that, there is also a trade-off between flying and eating. The more you eat, the harder it is to fly. So increasingly what happened was that instead of having just a light snack and then flying off, the birds would settle in for a rather larger meal and go for a waddle afterwards instead. So when eventually European settlers arrived and brought cats and dogs and stoats and possums with them, a lot of New Zealand's flightless birds were suddenly waddling for their lives. The kiwis, the takahes, and the old night parrots, the kakapos. Of these, the kakapo is the strangest. Well, I suppose the penguin is a pretty peculiar kind of creature when you think about it, but it's a quite robust kind of peculiarness, and the bird is perfectly well adapted to the world in which it finds itself, in a way that the kakapo is not. The kakapo is a bird out of time. If you look one in its large, round, greeny-brown face, it has a look of serenely innocent incomprehension that makes you want to hug it and tell it that everything will be all right, though you know that it probably will not be. It is an extremely fat bird. A good-sized adult will weigh about 6 or 7 pounds, and its wings are just about good for waggling a bit if it thinks it's about to trip over something. But flying is completely out of the question. Sadly, however, it seems that not only has the kakapo forgotten how to fly, but it has also forgotten that it has forgotten how to fly. Apparently a seriously worried kakapo will sometimes run up a tree and jump out of it, whereupon it flies like a brick and lands in a graceless heap on the ground. By and large, though, the kakapo has never learnt to worry. It's never had anything much to worry about. Most birds, faced with a predator, will at least realise that something's up and make a bolt for safety, even if it means abandoning any eggs or chicks in its nest. But not the kakapo. Its reaction when confronted with a predator is that it simply doesn't know what the form is. It has no conception of the idea that anything could possibly want to hurt it, so it tends just to sit on its nest in a state of complete confusion and leaves the other animal to make the next move, which is usually a fairly swift and final one. It's frustrating to think of the difference that language would make. The millennia crawl by pretty bloody slowly, while natural selection sifts its way obliviously through generation after generation, favouring the odd aberrant kakapo that's a little twitchier than its contemporaries, till the species as a whole finally gets the idea. It would all be cut short in a moment if one of them could say, "When you see one of those things with whiskers and little bitey teeth, run like hell." On the other hand, human beings, who are almost unique in having the ability to learn from the experience of others, are also remarkable for their apparent disinclination to do so. The trouble is that this predator business has all happened rather suddenly in New Zealand, and by the time nature starts to select in favour of slightly more nervous and fleet-footed kakapos, there won't be any left at all, unless deliberate human intervention can protect them from what they can't deal with themselves. It would help if there were plenty of them being born, but this brings us on to more problems. The kakapo is a solitary creature. It doesn't like other animals. It doesn't even like the company of other kakapos. One conservation worker we met said he sometimes wondered if the mating call of the male didn't actively repel the female, which is the sort of biological absurdity you otherwise only find in discotheques. The ways in which it goes about mating are wonderfully bizarre, extraordinarily long drawn out, and almost totally ineffective. Here's what they do. The male kakapo builds himself a track and bowl system, which is simply a roughly dug shallow depression in the earth with one or two pathways leading through the undergrowth towards it. The only thing that distinguishes the tracks from those that would be made by any other animal blundering its way about is that the vegetation on either side of them is rather precisely clipped. The kakapo is looking for good acoustics when he does this. So the track and bowl system will often be sighted against a rock, facing out across a valley, and when the mating season arrives, he sits in his bowl and booms. This is an extraordinary performance. He puffs out two enormous air sacs on either side of his chest, sinks his head down into them, and starts to make what he feels are sexy grunting noises. These noises gradually descend in pitch, resonate in his two air sacs, and reverberate through the night air, filling the valleys for miles around with the eerie sound of an immense heart beating in the night. The booming noise is deep, very deep, just on the threshold of what you can actually hear and what you can feel. This means that it carries for very great distances, but that you can't tell where it's coming from. If you're familiar with certain types of stereo setups, you'll know that you can get an additional speaker called a subwoofer, which carries only the bass frequencies, and which you can, in theory, stick anywhere in the room, even behind the sofa. The principle is the same. You can't tell where the bass sound is coming from. The female kakapo can't tell where the booming is coming from either, which is something of a shortcoming and a mating call. Come and get me! Where are you? Come and get me! Where the hell are you? Come and get me! Look, do you want me to come or not? Come and get me! Oh, for heaven's sake! Come and get me! Go and stuff yourself, is roughly how it would go in human terms. As it happens, the male has a wide variety of other noises it can make as well, but we don't know what they're all for. Well, I only know what I'm told, of course, but zoologists who've studied the bird for years say that they don't know what it's all in aid of. The noises include a high-frequency metallic nasal ching noise, humming, bill-clicking, scraaking. Scraaking is simply what it sounds like. The bird goes scraak a lot. Screech-crowing, pig-like grunts and squeals, duck-like warks, and donkey-like braying. There are also the distress calls that the young make when they trip over something or fall out of trees, and these make up yet another wide range of long-drawn-out, vibrant, complaining croaks. I've heard a tape of collected kakapo noises, and it's almost impossible to believe that it all just comes from a bird, or indeed any kind of animal. Pink Floyd's studio outtakes, perhaps, but not a parrot. Some of these other noises get heard in the later stages of courtship. The chinging, for instance, which doesn't carry so well, is very directional, and can help any females that have been aroused by night after night of booming, it sometimes goes on for 7 hours a night for up to 3 months, to find a mate. This doesn't always work, though. Females in breeding condition have been known to turn up at completely unoccupied bowls, wait around for a while, and then go away again. It's not that they're not willing. When they're in breeding condition, their sex drive is extremely strong. One female kakapo is known to have walked 20 miles in one night to visit a mate, and then walked back again in the morning. Unfortunately, however, the period during which the female is prepared to behave like this is rather short. As if things aren't difficult enough already, the female can only come into breeding condition when a particular plant, the podocarp, for instance, is bearing fruit. This only happens every 2 years. Until it does, the male can boom all he likes, it won't do him any good. The kakapo's pernickety dietary requirements are a whole other area of exasperating difficulty. It makes me tired just to think of them, so I think we'll pass quickly over all that. Imagine being an airline steward trying to serve meals to a plane full of Muslims, Jews, vegetarians, vegans, and diabetics when all you've got is turkey because it's Christmas time, and that'll give you the idea. The males therefore get extremely overwrought, sitting in their bowls, making noises for months on end, waiting for their mates, who are waiting for a particular type of tree to fruit. When one of the rangers who was working in an area where kakapos were booming happened to leave his hat on the ground, he came back later to find a kakapo attempting to ravish it. On another occasion, the discovery of some ruffled possum fur in the mating area suggested that a kakapo had made another alarming mistake, an experience which is unlikely to have been satisfying to either party. The net result of all these months of excavating and booming and walking and scraaking and being fussy about fruit is that once every 3 or 4 years, the female kakapo lays one single egg, which promptly gets eaten by a stoat. So the big question is, how on earth has the kakapo managed to last this long? Speaking as a non-zoologist confronted with this bird, I couldn't help but wonder if nature, freed from the constraints of having to produce something that would survive a great deal of competition, wasn't simply making it up as it went along. Doodling, in fact. How about sticking this bit in? Can't do any harm. Might be quite entertaining. In fact, the kakapo is a bird that in some ways reminds me of the British motorbike industry. It had things its own way for so long that it simply became eccentric. The motorbike industry didn't respond to market forces because it wasn't particularly aware of them. It built a certain number of motorbikes, and a certain number of people bought them, and that was that. It didn't seem to matter much that they were noisy, complicated to maintain, sprayed oil all over the place, and had their own very special way, as T. E. Lawrence discovered at the end of his life, of going round corners. That was what motorbikes did, and if you wanted a motorbike, that was what you got. End of story. And, of course, it very nearly was the end of the story for the British industry when the Japanese suddenly got the idea that motorbikes didn't have to be that way. They could be sleek, they could be clean, they could be reliable and well-behaved. Maybe then a whole new world of people would buy them, not just those whose idea of fun was spending Sunday afternoon in the shed with an oily rag or marching on Aqaba. These highly competitive machines arrived in the British Isles. Again, it's an island species that has never learnt to compete hard. I know that Japan is a bunch of islands too, but for the purposes of this analogy, I'm cheerfully going to ignore the fact. And British motorbikes almost died out overnight. Almost, but not quite. They were kept alive by a bunch of enthusiasts who felt that, though the Nortons and Triumphs might be difficult and curmudgeonly beasts, they had guts and immense character, and the world would be a much poorer place without them. They have been through a lot of difficult changes in the last decade or so, but have now re-emerged, re-engineered, as highly prized bike lovers' bikes. I think this analogy is now in serious danger of breaking down, so perhaps I'd better abandon it.